Welcome, and thank you for joining us this evening. The UC San Diego Division of Biological Sciences is pleased to present the last in this series of lectures called Gray Matters from Molecules to Mind. As you just heard, my name is Eduardo Macaño, and I had the great pleasure 3 years ago of introducing our first speaker who spoke on stem cells. So we're going to be going from stem cells to a well-organized brain, which is what our speaker is going to talk about today. This series was developed in partnership with the Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind at UC San Diego. And it features some of the San Diego's leading neuroscientists talking about the latest advances in our understanding of the human brain. The series was conceived as a way of informing our community about the exciting new findings going on in this area of research in San Diego. We happen to be arguably the best place in the world to do neuroscience. We have a number of research institutions that have a lot of representation in this area. Tonight's lecturer is Professor Harvey Carton of the UC San Diego School of Medicine. I have known Harvey for many, many years, and I have admired his work, and I think you will actually get a wonderful lecture tonight. Harvey's long scientific career has had as its main focus understanding the structure and function of vertebrate brains, particularly those of birds. Harvey was born and raised in New York City, which, contrary to popular misconceptions on the West Coast, is actually full of birds. He majored in chemistry and graduated from Yeshiva College and then went on to Einstein College of Medicine and to get his MD degree. Although he initially trained in internal medicine and psychiatry, guided and influenced by the distinguished neuroanatomist Wally Nauta, he chose scientific research over medical practice. And I think we've all gained for that, Harvey. His work on the organization of the avian brain has uncovered many of the neurological mechanisms that mediate the extraordinary auditory and visual capabilities of birds. As you know, you can have an eagle at, you know, hundreds of feet up in the air, capable of seeing a small movement and actually going after its prey. That's just one of the capacities that, in fact, we don't have, but birds have. Those studies of Harvey's have provided surprising new insights into the evolutionary origins of the cortex of mammals and the realization that birds and mammals have in common many neurological mechanisms that provide sensory analysis of the external world to the brains of both birds and mammals. Harvey has been on the faculties of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology as well as the State University of New York at Stony Brook, but since 1986 has been at the University of California, San Diego as a distinguished professor and member of the departments of neurosciences and psychiatry in the School of Medicine. He maintains also faculty appointments at the Scripps Research Institute and the University of Utah. I don't know why, but...
Skiing,
excuse me. I should have guessed. I thought he was looking at birds up there. Not quite. He has received many honors, among which are the Herrick Award and the Krieg Cortical Discoverer Award of the Cajal Club, and has been a distinguished visiting professor, Weir-Smith professor at Caltech. So please join me in welcoming Harvey Carton, who will speak on bird brains, pretty darn smart.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. Ladies and gentlemen, it's really a distinguished event in my life to give a talk at the Museum of Natural History. As a young boy in New York City, for many of us, and that was certainly true of my friend Stephen Gould, the late Stephen Gould, walking into the museum and seeing that giant whale hanging above us really was an awe-inspiring event. It made us feel just how overwhelming the world was, and yet how accessible it could be, and how exciting it could be to learn about that. What I would like to do today is to carry you on a journey, and I hope it won't be too fast. I'm given often to speaking too rapidly. About the nature of bird brains, dinosaurs, and how studying bird brains has taught us some rather surprising insights into the nature of mammalian cortex and how it all began. Certainly, birds are amongst the creatures that we are most familiar with. That is, we don't often pay much attention to squirrels. We certainly avoid rattlesnakes. And there are a whole range of wonderful invertebrates that are very rich in our environment here, but birds always play a very special role in people's minds and in the world around us. We don't tend to think of them as lowly creatures. We think of them as something rather strange in some ways, and if you just go to the beach, and this was at Carlsbad, you almost have the feeling that this is nature's way of saying, this is Michelangelo reaching out and giving something to a fellow creature on this planet. And what they do is actually they can look, they can see, they can recognize, they can operate on complex things. And it leaves us with the question of what sort of brain do these birds have? How is it organized? How does it differ from the brains of mammals? And what are the capabilities of birds? One of the striking things that we are aware of increasingly is just how clever birds can be without really knowing what we mean by clever. One example of that is certainly shown in this example from Weir's work on Caledonian crows. The crow has seen other birds fetch food out from this tube. It can't reach it. It's in a cylinder down at the bottom there. The bird picks up a straight wire, struggles with it, doesn't do very well with it. It's just not able to pick it out. Takes the wire out, looks around, puts the wire under a part of the rock, and then does something very, very, very interesting. My 2-year-old granddaughter won't do that yet. I hope she does. And then lifts it out. Now, this is just one small example. The Caledonian crow is not the smartest of all the birds that we see. But wait a second, what do we mean by smart? A hummingbird is really smart when it has to hover in flight in a flower blowing in the wind. We're not sure what we mean by smart. But what we can ask is, when we examine sensory behavior, what do we know about how the brain processes it? The issues that then come up is, how are brains of non-mammals organized? How do mammalian brains process the information? And is it different from the way that birds and reptiles process it? In fact, do we really know enough about how it is processed in mammals to say, okay, now, how did it get to do it this specific way? And it turns out we are making enormous progress in understanding how mammalian brains process information, but we are literally at the very edge of knowledge in understanding those things. If we now ask, well, how do birds do it? And does that tell us anything about the evolutionary process? In fact, we were at a total standstill on this. 40 years ago, we had no idea at all about the organization of brains of birds or of reptiles. We had only the scantest information, and I'll give you an idea of that in a few minutes. And where do birds fit into all of this? Because certainly, it wasn't only that giant whale that so impressed me and impressed so many others, but those incredible dinosaurs. Every child loves a dinosaur. It's as if you said, every child loves a pit bull. Hardly the case. It doesn't really make sense, but there is something awesome about it. In approximately 1880, the famous Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, looked at birds, looked at some of the early dinosaur fossils, and he said, birds are dinosaurs. They have feathers. They have beaks instead of teeth, but they're dinosaurs based on so many properties. And that idea wasn't too well accepted. And the first bird as such that was really recognized was Archaeopteryx. It was found in the Zollinghof shales in Germany. And this is an example of that, one of the really beautiful examples of Archaeopteryx. And you can see there are very distinct feathers, those long vane-like feathers. The head is up at the top center of the screen. Let's see if I can point to that right there. For over 100 years, the notion was that really wasn't the case, and there were a number of people who argued, well, birds are not dinosaurs, they're really quite different. But there was a persistent notion that there were an awful lot of similarities, particularly to the velociraptors. And then beginning in 1996-97, there was a finding made in a fossil bed in Montana, in Bamberge fossil shales, and then again over the next ten years, dozens of new fossils. This is a true dinosaur. And the question was, did they have feathers? And these fossils were so numerous and so beautifully preserved out of China that you could see these marvelous feathers. It's now even thought that perhaps Tyrannosaurus rex may have had a feathery integument as well. Some of the early feathered dinosaurs look sort of like this by our best reconstructions. And you notice they tend to rest more on their hind legs, characteristic of this whole line of dinosaurs. And this is one of the most recent of the feathered dinosaurs that really is looking an awful lot like a bird. It still has teeth. It doesn't have the typical beak. And I surely would not want to think of walking across San Marcos Plaza and think that I was being surrounded by these 8 to 10-foot dinosaurs that would fly down. Our latest views, then, of the way the dinosaurs sit in relationship to other animals within this lineage of primitive archosaurs is that they are, in fact, dinosaurs. They're right out of that. So when we talk about what we find in birds, we really are gaining some insight into how it might be in the brains of dinosaurs. And to that degree, it leads us to ask questions about other reptiles and then perhaps to gain some insight into what we might uncover about how mammalian brains emerged out of those early reptiles. Well, you're all aware of Darwin. It's incredible work, published in 1859 after many years of dwelling on his work on the beagle. There was an enormous outroar in response to Darwin. The idea that we were related to other creatures, yeah, it was sort of okay in a vague sort of way. But what was the real core issue? Can we imagine that Reverend Wilberforce really objected very strongly to the notion that our liver was like that of a monkey? Well, no. Actually, what the center of that whole argument was really focused on the brain. Was our brain, was our identity, was our concepts of self, was our very nature as a human being really a biological expression? Or to quote Woody Allen, "But the brain is my second favorite organ." Well, how do you study brain evolution? Well, one way you can study it, and the way we've often studied it in the past, was to look at fossils. But fossils don't tell us the real story about what we're interested in brains. Our interests in brains are not what the outside shape of it they might be, but what their internal organization is, how they process information, what the nature of the cells are, what their communication as a network is, and how they achieve the goals of these very subtle operations that brains participate in. So we want to know, it's what's inside that counts. Comparison of the different brains, based on what we can see with the naked eye, doesn't really tell us very much. It's useful to some degree. And this shows what different brains look like. The one at the lower left is a human brain, is a drawing of a human brain. Figure E is a cat, D is a pigeon, C is an alligator, B is a frog, and A is a trout. Now, the thing that stands out, actually, to a comparative anatomist such as myself, is that if we were to look at the spinal cord, which is down about here in each of these, the basic structure and the organization and the wiring diagram of it and the cell types and their connections are identical. There's virtually no difference. There's an area called the cerebellum here, and here, and here in birds, for instance, participates in organizing motor patterns. Looks exactly the same. It can vary in size. The thing that was really different to everybody's mind is what's happening up here in this area that we call the forebrain, that in mammals is dominated on the outside by this thing we call cortex. Well, how are avian brains organized? The first question when I approached this a long time ago was, if I look at the circuitry in the textbooks, there's no real description that compares to that in the textbooks that describe mammalian brains, where there are nice orderly inputs from the periphery. So something goes into our ear and it goes to this particular part of my brainstem. And from there it goes to something called the thalamus. And from there it goes on to the cortex. That defines one example of a sensory pathway. And I'll spend time just concentrating on one pathway today, on the auditory pathway. We had no idea. Do birds process sound in the same way? We know that birds listen. They not only sing, they hear other birds sing. They can learn vocalizations. If you look at parrots, their vocalization, even in the wild, is quite extraordinary. So do birds have similar circuits? Just how extensive are the differences between bird brains and those of mammals? And what might that teach us about the evolutionary origins of our brains by studying the brains of birds and other reptiles? Well, a human brain looks like this. And all those different speckles and spots and circles indicate that when an anatomist looks at these different areas, they all look slightly different, but they're all cortex. And if we would take a slice through that cortex at the back end, the area that is very much involved in, you're looking at that slide. It's called the visual cortex or striate cortex. The thing that stands out is there are all of those cells there. And there's the white matter, and on the outside of it, following this curve, is the gray matter. The name of these lectures, as a matter of fact. And that gray matter is characterized by being very notably layered, or what we call laminated, with different densities and different sizes of cells in each of those layers, and an extraordinarily complex network that we're just barely starting to understand. Now, if an animal has a cortex, this is called the neocortex, because this structure was only seen in mammals. All mammals, monotremes, that is duckbill platypus, echidnas, marsupials, and placental mammals. If an animal has this thing that looks like that, it's a mammal. It's a good taxonomic sign. If it doesn't have a neocortex, it's not a mammal. The presence or absence of that neocortex, meaning new cortex, presents as a binary event in the evolution of brains. Now, binary events means that you're either this way or that way. There are very, very, very few events in all of biology that are truly binary. It's an unusual opportunity, particularly if you're interested in molecular biology, to ask what flips the switch. But before you can answer what flips the switch, you really want to know what is it that's being flipped on and off. One way to approach this is to ask which areas of the brain in birds process auditory and visual behaviors. Are they similar to the ones that process similar behaviors in mammals? Now, much of the information we do have is actually based on studies of rats, and to a much lesser extent, studies of monkeys and humans. That in reality, this work is very tedious, very laborious, and unless you really happen to like tedious things, it's really boring to do. But if you like hiding in a lab and looking through a microscope or listening to things coming out of the loudspeaker while it's blipping away on an oscilloscope or fiddling in a lab and doing all sorts of fancy tricks in molecular biology, actually, this can be really exciting stuff. Part of the reason it's exciting is because it's fun to play with the toys. But it's also exciting to look at things that other people have looked at and suddenly see it in a different way. And I'll try to convey what it was we saw that made that difference. Now, we know from a wide range of studies, clinical as well as laboratory studies, that the human brain has a wide range of specialized zones across the surface. All of those spotted areas with crosses and stars and circles correspond to different regions of the cortex. So at the back end to the right of the screen is vision. And on this lobe here, that's called the temporal lobe, you can see this area dedicated to hearing. And I'm going to focus on that. Now, a quick course in mammalian brain organization. It's really hard to talk about what has evolved unless you have an idea of what the two divergent points might be that you would then try to tie together. The vast majority of work on brains has concentrated largely on studying a very limited number of mammalian brains. We knew nothing about these same detailed features of the organization of the brain in non-mammals. So how could we begin to guesstimate how that transition occurred if we don't even know what the nature of the transition might be? So a quick course on mammalian brain organization. Sensory pathways come in from your eyes, from your ears, from the skin, from a variety of structures, and they project onto lower level structures in the brain before they get up to that upper gray matter. After various levels of various degrees of processing, they go through a major central distribution center called the thalamus, and from there they project onto the cortex. I won't go into any more detail than that, so you don't have to worry too much about it. There's an associated structure of great importance, though, called the basal ganglia. I don't know if many of you have heard about it, but you've all heard of Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's disease is a disease that profoundly affects the basal ganglia. We're not quite sure even what it really does, the basal ganglia, but it's been around a very long time. Now, for many years, there was the notion that mammals have basal ganglia and cortex, and birds, well, they just have a giant basal ganglia, and I'll show you why in a moment. In the longitudinal organization, that is spinal cord to brainstem to cerebellum to thalamus and then to cortex, there are commonalities in the organization as a long axis, like a giant piece of celery going from the spinal cord up to the very top end of the brain. That's common to all vertebrates. But the specialized area for mammals that struck everybody as unique was this cortex. But where did it come from? What's its evolutionary history? And is it uniquely mammalian? One of the critical things that really has been increasingly appreciated, perhaps as much because of the genome project as anything else, is that vertebrates are a very, very highly conserved group of mammals, of animals rather, all vertebrates. It's not just the spinal cords that's the same. There are similarities in the way the whole organism develops. Similar genes are involved in elaborating the development of the body, setting up poles of the body, the way the embryo elaborates itself. A primary postulate, then, is that homologous cells, that is, cells that share a common origin in different animals, different vertebrates, mediate similar behaviors most of the time. A good example, the pituitary does a lot of the same stuff. The adrenal gland, heart. A secondary postulate is that this applies to neurons as well, but it applies not only to the individual neuron types, but to the circuits that it makes. This is a much more contentious argument because it's a lot easier to say, well, every vertebrate is totally different and it's all made anew. It's really turning back the clock on Darwinian concepts. How do we study brains? So I'd like to give you a really fast course in some of the methods just to give you a sense of the aesthetics of them. We have a variety of ways of studying things. But the best way is follow Yogi Berra's edict. You can observe a lot by just watching. And as a neuroanatomist, I do a lot of watching. So I can look at a section like this, and I see lots of cells, but it doesn't tell me very much about what's going on between them. And this was the level of analysis that was available by about 1870. A major change occurred shortly after that in about 1880 when an Italian neuroanatomist, Camillo Golgi, discovered what he called la reazione nera, or the black reaction, in which he took pieces of tissue and put it into a silver and chromate mix, looked at it a while later, and he saw images, as drawn here in the work of Santiago Ramón y Cajal, one of the true founders of modern neurobiology. For their joint contributions, they received the Nobel Prize in 1906. It was a joint award to the two of them, and we have just passed the centenary. What is truly astounding is to most neurobiologists, today even, if you want to really be sure that you got the story right, go see if Cajal described it first. Because if he did, that's almost considered to be as good as doing it all over again. But what he brought with it was an incredible aesthetic. These drawings were so astonishingly accurate. And yet he would draw them after a night of carousing or doing other things in the cafes in Madrid. And he would then lie in bed the next morning with his cup of cocoa and his India ink pens, and he would draw these cells from memory. And using our most modern current methods with confocal microscopy and intracell filling, in fact, his findings hold up amazingly well. But we also rely increasingly on new methods as we go because there are things that you really couldn't do with that. And this is one example where we now use tracers that we inject in one part of the brain. So we inject a chemical tracer, and then that is transported back. This is much like dissecting out a radio. For those of you who are old enough to remember when we had vacuum tubes and before we had integrated circuits, you would take a radio, and it had all these vacuum tubes, and you'd take it out of the case, and you turn it upside down, and there were all these components. And what you would want to do, if you were curious about this, is to try to figure out what was connected to what. You do a component analysis or a finite component analysis. You then try to figure out how are they connected and what do each of them do. And in a sense, that's what I've been doing. Sometimes I think I'm not doing things very differently than I was doing it when I was 12 years old in dissecting radios. And these new methods, however, allow us to identify unique types of cells that go to this area. This is tracing. That is, we discovered by this method where this spot of chemical was injected. It caused these cells to light up. Not only did it light up the cells, but it lit up the processes of the cells. And when we filled them using a still more recent technique, using slices of the brain, and then recording from these cells, fill the cells and reconstruct it, you can see one cell with this incredible auberization. And we can see not only the cell with the target of the inputs from other neurons, but we can see the output process called the axon that goes from one neuron to talk to another neuron. And we can reconstruct it in three-dimensional glory using some of our most modern computers and some of our elegant laser-based scanning confocal microscopes. We can also pick out the detailed chemistry, as shown here. This is a retina. This happens to be a monkey retina. And this is showing this odd pattern of staining where the cells that detect light, called the photoreceptors that are up here, carry within them a molecule that reflects their sensitivity to cannabinoids. These are quite naturally occurring molecules, and this is a very dramatic example of how photoreceptors do respond to this. So what do we measure when we try to do evolutionary studies? Well, one of the critical notions that has great depth to the field of invertebrate neurobiology was the idea that there are discrete numbers of cells and each of them have discrete identities. This is an idea that's been very, very slow to be accepted in the vertebrate community, but it's long been accepted. And it is now coming to be realized that we have discrete types of cells, very, very discrete types of cells. And how do they differ from each other? Well, they differ from each other in the dendritic morphology, those elaborate little trees coming off from the cell body that define the character of the cell by the nature of its inputs and its inputs. Afferents, that means the axons or the sources of input to it, afferent, carrying it to it, or efferent, the axons that go from here to someplace else. We look at the transmitter and other molecular properties of the cells. We stick small electrodes in the cells and record their electrical properties and discover that two different cells, right next to each other, but with some different chemical properties, also have very different electrical properties. We look at their intrinsic rhythms and endogenous patternings and their relative location. So how do non-mammals process information? Oh, by the way, just gives you an idea of the richness and hopefully a little bit of the aesthetics of the methods that we use. Scientists love their methods as much as they love the data because it's fun. It's nice to look at it, and it depends on what aesthetic turns you on. So how do non-mammals process information? The strategy is to choose a closely related animal with similar behavioral capabilities. And it turns out birds are pretty good at that. That is, they work in the same environments that we do. They do a lot of the same tasks that we do. And I mean we as mammals, as a group. The question is, how do they process information? Well, this is what a pigeon brain looks like. Now, in my life, the pigeon brain is the highest class of vertebrate, the highest representative of all vertebrates. It's what I've worked on my whole life, practically. And what it looks like is like any other small bird of this sort. Here's the spinal cord. This is the cerebellum. Here's where the optic nerve comes in. It's called the optic tract, and then it crosses in the optic chiasm, very much like as in mammals. This area of the thalamus is under here, and there's this huge forebrain. You look at that, and, you know, that's pretty big. That's much bigger, relatively speaking, than that of a rat. This is a picture of a rat forebrain, and you immediately will see it between comparing this to the next slide. One of the first things that immediately appeared so different to people when they started to look at bird brains 130 years ago. Rats, as with all mammals, are characterized by having lots of white matter down here and layered cortex up above. Now, many mammals, this will be an enormous system, this cortex. And the other major component is this region down below called the basal ganglia, or caudiputamen, the area that's involved as in Parkinson's disease, in tremor, in Huntington's disease, and many other such diseases. If we look at it in a bird brain, it looks very different. The thing that stands out, first of all, is that, gee, there seems to be only this little piece of cortex out here, outside the ventricle, and there's this huge area here sticking into the ventricle. So the first reaction that people had to this, when the papers first described the structure of the bird brain, was to say, gee, they have this big basal ganglia and no cortex. So where did cortex come from? Because actually, that's what most reptiles look like. It reflected the apparent novelty and extensive nature of the laminated structure on the external aspect of the telencephalon. From the very beginning, neocortex, or new cortex of mammals, was described and defined as a unique component of mammalian brains. Well, if you're going to say that it's a unique component of the mammalian brain, it means there's no way you're going to find it in anything except a mammal. You've constructed what is a damn near perfect tautology. So, neocortex had no prior history. Well, that turns out that's really hard to believe. Virtually everything else has some history to it. The secret to it all lies in just a fairly simple set of propositions. The history of the constituent neurons and the circuits of the cortex actually do have an ancient history. It's just a laminar juxtaposition, the forming of layers that appears to be relatively novel. Now, I gave the example a few moments ago also, where we think of this as homology at the cellular level, the way we would think of, let's say, the insulin-secreting cells of the pancreas. They're not uniquely mammalian. You see them in all classes of vertebrates, or certain immune cells. If we look at a model of a bird reptile brain, then, what we see is here's the midline. This is the area up here that we refer to as the hippocampus, which is involved in memory, and we now know in birds it's involved in memory, as in mammals and in seed storing. And over here we have this basal ridge, dorsal ridge, and this little cortex, this thin puny cortex. But the real basal ganglia, the caudate putamen, only turns out to be this much. What's the rest of all of that? And that was the mystery that we posed in 1963, actually. So we have to understand how is auditory and sensory system organized in order to understand something about cortex. And in order to further understand the nature of the question, maybe it would be helpful to say, well, what do we mean by cortex? One way to think of it is in terms of a simple neuronal circuit. That is, if we see a layered structure like cortex, the thing that we find within it by working out the circuitry is that the sensory inputs, let's say from our ear or from our eye, come up from this region called the thalamus, which sits below the cortex, and ends in massive density, usually in a single layer. One region for sound, another for sight, another for touch. But the input axons end within layer 4. That's just the way we number it. The neurons go from 4 to the overlying layers of 2, 3, and to some degree a little bit to the deeper layers, but mostly up above. Now, it's actually a very intricate network that goes on between here. It's not just two neurons. It's dozens of types, if not hundreds of types of neurons that do the process. The output then goes to a group of neurons lying in the deeper layers, and they go downstream, and they act on the periphery or modify even the sensory input. So the properties of cortex are that there are laminar populations with specific inputs and outputs, afferents and efferents, as we call them, that the cells within it have different morphologies and different molecular properties. But the other qualities are really important, and I'm going to come back to that at the very end. That is, we also know that there is an intricate network there in which things talk to each other within a vertical column across these layers, and they go back and forth. There are recurrent loops, feedback loops, and modification loops back and forth across that, as well as when some of the information goes out to another area, it sends modified information back in called a reentrant loop. When we turned our attention to look at the auditory system, because the auditory system is so important for birds, what we discovered was that the organization of the system really is amazingly similar to mammals. In 1898, very inspired worker, Adolf Wallenberg in Germany, showed that the ear here is shown uncoiled. In mammals, it's coiled. But it's exactly the same structure. It's the same hair cells, and the loss of those hair cells will cause deafness, as in mammals. And it terminates on a group of dedicated neurons here called the cochlear nuclei. And the organization is astonishing, like that of mammals. And Wallenberg then showed that the projections of that system go up to the midbrain area and end there in a region called the inferior colliculus, exactly as in mammals. But that's where the story stopped. Using techniques that were then new in the 1960s, we were able to show that this goes on forward to end in the thalamus. And as exactly as in mammals, that nucleus in the thalamus had a different name than it did in mammals, but it had a beautiful organization with different frequencies mapped at different locations within it. We call that tonotopic organization. It's in a way analogous, but done in a slightly different way than when you think of what happens in the visual system. The image falls on your retina in a very spatially discrete manner. It's represented in a correspondingly spatially discrete manner in your thalamus and in your cortex. So there is really a map of your external world. For sound, it works differently. We don't have discrete sounds as such represented, but it turns out there is a map by tone. What was even more astounding, though, was that we then discovered that there was an output from this thalamic cell group to a region in the forebrain. It had been described only in a pure descriptive sense in that people said there's a funny group of cells here. And the author of that paper, Maximilian Rose, looked at it and said, you know, rather than give it all these fancy names, he said, there are so many different areas in the bird brain that didn't make sense. And prior to that, everybody assumed that all these areas in this region were sort of like basal ganglia. He didn't like that idea too much, but he didn't know what to make of it. So he said, look, I'm just going to call things by alphabetical numbers. It's as if, it's in a way, very much the way we label the stars. That is, we give them different names based on brightness or a variety of other qualities. In this case, he started with A and he went on through Z, and this happened to be field L. So he called it field L. When we looked at field L in more detail, we discovered, gee, it's right over here. It's this dark cluster, and it's made up of lots of small cells. And having been trained initially in mammalian neuroanatomy, I took one look at that and I said, gee, that looks like layer 4 of auditory cortex. Not a very popular notion at the time. And my friend Mark Kanishi, first at Princeton and then at Caltech, started recording from this and found, gee whiz, it's got tonotopic organization, exactly as does auditory cortex. This is really looking rather odd. We then went on from there, it took a number of years before I went back to this problem, and discovered, well, you know what? As in mammalian cortex, we have layers. Here you have discrete cell groups. So this area we now call L2, that was the original L, projects to something called L1 and then to HV and then back down in. And we start to say, gee, this is looking more and more and more like cortex, different cell types and different layers, but not quite the same way we were thinking of mammalian cortex. This led to a sort of a long time idea, which finally we've given up only in the last 2 years, that the auditory pathway in birds is organized in general principle, as in mammals, but you don't have this radial organization as you might have it here, similar to that drawing I showed you a while ago of the schematic of three neurons, that is, of inputs coming from thalamus here, that's supposed to be a cell body, ending in layer A, which is where it ends, and then into neurons up above, and then down to the output neurons and out here. In bird, what we were thinking was happening was it comes into this cell group, and this cell group goes here, and that cell group goes to the next one, and it finally comes out. Well, the difficulty with that is there's not much interaction. You have to then draw long loops back and forth, and we were sort of puzzled by this. But it did lead to this early formulation, which turns out still to be as best guess as we could make today, that the evolution of the brain and that bird brains really were tied together very closely as a solution. That in birds, we have the distinct populations that make up, in this case, layers 3, 4, 3, and 4, and then some of the other two populations finally going to the output cells. In mammals, you see that exact same organization, but it's spread out as layers. That's the whole trick. It's a difference in migration more than anything else. It's not as if the neurons were all new. The neurons have been there. Not only have they been there, they've probably been there for at least 400 million years. Because a former student of mine, many years ago now, has recently shown that in fish, the exact same system of organization of auditory input is occurring to a very similar region of the fish brain. Well, at that point, we stopped and said, okay, so what we have is we have a pseudo-lamination, but we don't really have the network. We sort of have something like it. So maybe we're overrating the virtues of laminar structure. You know, it's sort of as Pogo said, we've met the enemy and they are us. What unique properties does lamination have, and what does it confer upon the ability of those animals to do a job? Now, if you listen to a bird sing, or listen to two Java Hill miners talk, or sing to each other, it's quite astounding. They can respond with time differences of the order of 50 microseconds. Microseconds. It's astounding. How are they doing that? Are they really doing it with what we want to call an inefficient system, or are we missing something really serious? And as network analysts, it's really bothersome to try to be stuck with this sort of a problem for so many years. So we had cells coming in to the eye, to the intrinsic thalamic recipient neurons. We always make up abbreviations. It's one of the things scientists love to do. But the other properties of cortex, so we met the properties in some ways, laminar population with specific afferents and efferents. We showed, in fact, by filling many of the cells, their different morphologies and showed that they corresponded to the cells that you would see in cortex. They had the same molecular properties. But how's about this radial organization, recurrent loops and reentrance? That really bothered us a lot. It turns out the solution really began for this in one of the really beautiful pieces of work by one of the students of the famous Santiago Ramón y Cajal, a fellow called Laurenti Deneau, who showed up in Cajal's lab about 1922. That's 16 years after Cajal had won the Nobel Prize. And he said, oh, you've probably got it all wrong. And Cajal was not apparently very tolerant of this sort of thing. And Laurenti Deneau, though, was a very strong-willed young man and very brilliant. And he went ahead and he did a whole series of beautiful studies on cortex. He published them. The initial studies were mostly in Spanish, but they were eventually published in English. He went on from there because by this time, electrophysiology was a very exciting discipline, and he started to worry more about electrical properties of neurons. He was asked to write a chapter on the anatomy of the cortex, though, for a famous textbook, Fulton's Textbook of Physiology, as it was known, in 1937. He said, well, he doesn't work on that anymore, but okay, he'll throw something together. And what you see that he threw together was this drawing next to his picture. This was published in 1937. It was the first discrete example of a recurrent network within the cortex. That is, his mentor, Cajal, drew cells but didn't see them as networks. He saw connections and conveyance of information along these axons, but he never actually formulated it in this manner. At this point in time, we now recognize that, for instance, within that auditory cortex, and this would be a schematic of it, that we now recognize here's that thalamic cell group projecting up, ending in what we call layer 4, that this then has ascending projections to the overlying groups, which then go to the output cells down here. Now, this is barely doing justice to the complexity and the beauty of the system, but that's a first pass that we now can accept as being a great advance over what we had some years before. If we look at the area in birds that corresponds to this area for hearing in humans, what we now see are some other striking properties. This is some work of a friend of mine, Henning Scheich, in Magdeburg in Germany, in which he looked at guinea fowl, and he replicated an experiment that is widely done in many mammals, that is, provide an auditory stimulus to an animal and then examine the auditory part of the brain. And if you give two different frequencies, they form two distinct bands, in this case, 1 kilohertz and 4 kilohertz. This is slightly tilted, so you don't quite appreciate that, in fact, this is a tall column spanning those multiple layers that we had worked out the circuitry on. If we look at that in a stained section where you just see the cell bodies for the most part here. That would span the area from L3, L2, L1, all these subdivisions of L1 into HV. We asked the question, can we begin to see any indication of how these are really related to each other as a network? That is, does columnar radial organization exist in birds and in reptiles? Or is it something that's really uniquely mammalian? Maybe that's what makes the mammalian brain different. Using, again, still newer techniques of single-cell filling and micro-studies within a slice of the brain, where we really have to make a very exact small injection, Yuan Wang in my laboratory performed an elegant analysis of the system, of the auditory system. That is, the system that until that time, yeah, we sort of had a cookie-cutter diagram showing inputs going to L2A, and then L2 to L1, L3, and then HV coming back. But what's it really like? And using single injections, small injections of 50 micrometers, she was able to work out the interlaminar connections across these different layers of L1, L2, L3. One of the striking features of mammalian cortex that has fascinated neuroanatomists since the work of Laurenti Deneau in 37 is the prospect that there are columnar organizations within that area of the brain called the cortex. And one of the first things Yuan was able to show was this elegant, and this is with a fluorescent tag in this region right here, and it showed the same radial organization that has, we recognize as being supposedly unique to mammals. There it is in birds. And looking at the individual cells look like the cells in different layers. And when, in fact, we finally put the story together, the differences at the single-cell level appear less and less distinct between birds and mammals. Contrary to all our long-held beliefs, radial and columnar units exist in this region that we call the dorsal ventricular ridge, which is really equivalent, homologous, to the cells of the cortex. But it's not just the cells that are homologous. It's actually the circuits, the microcircuits, that do their operations. And when we record the physiological properties of the cells, it turns out they look exactly like those of cortex. That is, if we did the equivalent of a Turing test, and you didn't see who was using what animal to do the studies on, and you're standing behind a black curtain just staring at an oscilloscope and listening to a loudspeaker, you couldn't tell the difference between whether that recording was coming from a bird brain or coming from a mammalian brain. And most recently, Balthazar in Belgium recorded the responses of starlings using MRI, functional MRI, and showed that this area, Field L, that we discovered so many years ago, has all the exact same dynamic properties that you record from human cortex. Birds ain't that different after all. Where are we now? Well, the questions we now have to ask are, what are the molecular events that determine these highly conserved properties of cells and circuits? How is this coded within the genome? All of you have heard, sometimes wondering, why are scientists just so off the wall about figuring out the genome? And okay, I can understand why you want to do it in humans, because it'll help us understand disease, and maybe if you want to use mice as a good model, but why are we doing it in zebra finch and in zebra fish and in all these other creatures? Well, the really exciting thing that's happening now, and if I were to be starting my career again, that's where I would be doing it, is to look at the molecular genetics and ask, what actually makes the brain get together the way it does? What stores those features and what regulates the elaboration of those features that have been around for 400 and 500 million years at the level of the cell, at the level of the circuit, at the level of the total region? New things occur, but don't assume that every newly discovered thing is new as an evolutionary biologist. So what are the molecular events that mediate the modifications and alignment of the cells that lead to the evolution and development of the mammalian type of cortex? Because if you recall in one of my earlier slides, I said, you know, there are two secrets to this whole problem as we realized it. One is, cell type is preserved, cell circuit is preserved. The thing that changes is an independent event in evolution, is migration to make lamination. And that's actually what the story has turned out to be. So what is the significance for computational modeling of cortical processing? It turns out we still don't have an accurate schematic of the circuitry of any single piece of cortex. It's a deadly difficult problem. We have people such as Ed Calloway who are doing very beautiful work, working with extremely novel techniques to work out this microcircuitry. But in fact, we don't know how any complex processing of information occurs at the cortical level. The thing that does stand out is, looking back, is it's always beneficial to keep an historical perspective and to realize that the insights that Darwin gave us are still so very valid. I have called this principle by which each slight variation, if useful, is preserved by the term natural selection. In this case, the microcircuitry has been preserved in a very effective way. The other perspective that stands so well to all biologists was Dobzhansky's comment in 1973. Nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution. If we wish to understand the way a mammalian brain is organized, we have to understand how it came to be that way. The fact that what we're discovering is that most of the features that we thought were novel have actually been around for hundreds of millions of years. So we really now have to start from the drawing board again and say, okay, if that's the case, then what is novel? It's time to face that we don't have a good answer. When I first began this work, in 1961 actually, I came across a paragraph in a wonderful book by Henry Beston called Outermost House. It remains my favorite quotation. It has driven my thinking over the decades, and I'd like to read it to you. We need another and a wiser and perhaps a more mystical concept of animals. Remote from universal nature and living by complicated artifice, man in civilization surveys the creature through the glass of his knowledge and sees thereby a feature magnified and the whole image in distortion. We patronize them for their incompleteness, for their tragic fate of having taken form so far below ourselves. And therein we err, and greatly err. For the animal shall not be measured by man. In a world older and more complete than ours, they move finished and complete, gifted with extensions of the senses we have lost or never attained, living by voices we shall never hear. They are not brethren. They are not underlings. They are other nations, caught with ourselves in the net of life and time, fellow prisoners of the splendor and travail of the earth. Thank you very much. The boat is called Night Heron. And thanks to the many people over the years who have been so very helpful. How novel is this if we look at non-vertebrate chordates? Tunicates? Okay. Lampreys? Was a similar organization there. Some features of the organization are there. And in fact, it would be hard to imagine, given the small size of the forebrain regions in lampreys, that there is the similar circuitry. Are there one or two neurons that become a large population? We really don't know. In practice, we don't really have any detailed information. And I think the danger in evolutionary biology, when it comes to neurobiology particularly, has been to leap forward to a speculation, assuming the worst-case scenario in terms of the origins of things. We are so great, we have this, other creatures are lower than we are, they don't have it. And in a sense, that's one of the reasons why Beston's comment is such a salient comment. It reminds us we really don't know what other creatures are. They do very well. They are perfect in their environment. Now, do lampreys have an auditory system? No, they don't. They don't have a lot of the things. But we don't really know where these things come from. What is astounding is amongst vertebrates, which is the only thing that I can make any comment on. That is, sharks, fish, bony fish, amphibia, reptiles, and mammals. The similarities that we are uncovering are astounding. Those are similarities that were never suspected before. Where are the real differences? Well, you know, we haven't focused on the differences, and that's really a great and valid criticism of what we've done. We've been looking for evidence of similarities when none were thought to exist. But where are the differences? That has to be resolved. You mean amongst mammals? The question was, more particularly than what triggers this massive explosion in the size of the brains? That I don't know. I mean, it's always been a puzzle that when we look at dinosaurs, which had enormous bodies, that their brains did not increase proportionately as did the mammals, such as that wonderful great blue whale in the Museum of Natural History. There are many mammals with very, very big brains. Now, birds actually do have very disproportionately large brains. That is, if we look at brain size to body size, the overlying figures, when we lay out the curves, are, with a possible exception of a few primates, the two curves are absolutely, it's an enclosing parallelogram, are identical between birds and mammals. Dinosaurs really do fall down below it. So it's not a uniquely mammalian consequence, and we certainly don't have any more extant examples of the really large birds that lived until even 500 or 700 years ago. What determines brain size? It's hard to know. So we don't know why it has expanded the way it has.